This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Each weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now, Talking Health, presented by CHI Mercy Health. Now, here's Talking Health with Lisa Platt on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here. Kyle Bailey again and for Lisa Platt as we continue to spend this segment looking at COVID-19 and the Douglas Public Health Network and some of the related topics that are going on. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us. Also, Brian Mahoney from Douglas Public Health Network. Dr. Bob, let's start with you. And let's go in depth as we look at COVID-19 worldwide, nationally, statewide, and at the county level.
Well, I think worldwide, it's still a very active pandemic. Four of our days with highest number of new cases were in this last week. And so we're seeing a really brutal number of new cases throughout the world. Most of those cases are not in the U.S., and most of those cases are in Brazil, Peru, India, and Russia. Really widespread around the world where we're seeing lots of cases. The death rate throughout the world is going down a little bit, but still is incredibly high. We now have over 6 million cases and over 300,000 deaths. When we first did this back in January, there were 2 cases in the U.S. and no deaths. So we really see the incredible spread of this over the last 4 months. In terms of what's happening in the U.S., it's still very active in the U.S. in certain areas of the U.S., Chicago and other places in the Midwest seem to have lots of cases. So, for example, a few weeks ago, Minnesota and Oregon had the same number of cases. Minnesota now is in the mid-20s, and we're still at mid-20,000s, and we're still at around 4,000. In Oregon, we've risen very slowly. We still have the 4th lowest attack rate in the country and the 6th lowest death rate. So overall, Oregon is doing well. And Southern Oregon continues to do much better than the rest of the state. We've had a relatively quiet time over the last few weeks. We're up to 27 total cases and 25 recovered cases, only 2 active cases. Just one fellow remains in the hospital, but we understand that he's doing better. So we're feeling pretty quiet here in Douglas County. The rest of the world, not so much.
As we monitor this, and maybe it's the fact that things have been so quiet in the county, it makes people, if they don't have personal connections or friends in other places in the U.S. or perhaps elsewhere, it's probably easy to look at this a bit skeptically and you know, not realize the magnitude of what we're dealing with on a global level and in the U.S. as well.
I think that's correct. When I started doing emergency management, someone said, you'll never be right. If you, by 1% underprepare and there's more than you're prepared for, people will criticize you for being underprepared. But if you do a great job and are well prepared and there's not a bad outcome, then people will criticize you for doing too much. And I think we're in the latter part of it, but I'd much rather be there than the other way.
You mentioned some of the countries around the world where things are hitting harder right now. What do you know about those areas? And also, what about their available medical care?
Right. So the areas that are getting hit the hardest now are areas that did not have a lot of cases early on, but did have a sort of later start to this. In each of those countries, there's been a bit of denial about getting the disease. So Brazil is a great example of a country who said, oh, this is just bad flu. We're not going to worry about it. We're so close to the equator, it'll never strike here. And sadly, now they have the second highest number of cases and soon will have the second highest number of deaths in the world. The other thing we worry about in places like Brazil and Peru and Mexico and Bangladesh is that they don't have well-developed medical care systems. And, you know, we're afraid that they're not going to do enough testing. They're not going to do enough treatment. There's going to be a lot of deaths as well as a lot of spread. So if we look, for example, in Brazil, about half of the tests they've done have been positive. You know, remember, we're supposed to get the positivity rate down less than 2%. They're over 50%, suggesting that they're barely testing anyone at all, and yet they still have this huge rate.
What about their infrastructure? I mean, is this something, some people in the U.S. felt like there were parts of the country that were slow here, but if you don't have the physical infrastructure of a medical system to begin with, it's hard to jump in and address these things so quickly, even if you're trying to.
Yes. So we can see that in Europe and the U.S., we have very advanced medical system, and it was hard on us. I can imagine the strain on places like Brazil is going to be enormous.
And you mentioned Russia as well.
Now, Russia's been an interesting area. They report a large number of cases, a tiny number of deaths, yet there are news reports and press reports that the government is tremendously undercounting both deaths and cases. We do not know what's happening in those cases. Similarly, in Brazil, there's been a suggestion that they've been hiding cases. So it's going to be really hard to know what the real numbers are.
Well, it's interesting because obviously there's all these relationships or lack thereof between various countries. And some, the protocol tends to be fairly trusting of them, and other places, not so much. So that makes it just throws another wrinkle. What about parts of the U.S. again that you said are getting harder hit right now? What do you know about those areas?
So it seems to be the areas that were not hit hard in the beginning. Chicago especially seems to be under real trouble, where they've had more cases and more deaths in the last week. In addition, some of the upper Midwest states where their meatpacking plants have really been hit. And Minnesota, as we'd said, really did a great job early on, but they've just really exploded in the number of cases. And we worry with the protests and whatever that's been going on in Minnesota that will further spread. I think when people are so angry as that and crowd so much as that, I don't think they're thinking about social distancing.
Interesting. Well, and in the U.S., obviously there is all this emotion, all of this going on right now. And regardless of people's perspectives on that area, just the physical aspect of, I know there was a section of Portland, for instance, last night, one of the protests where there were, I believe, the estimate from the city police was 6,000 people that had quickly assembled in a particular area. With all the things we've talked about, that's certainly the opposite of social distancing.
That is exactly the opposite of social distancing. And when we talk about social distancing in places and being able to do contact tracing, imagine how impossible it would be if one of those people turns positive now to say, well, tell me all those people you were close to in the last 2 weeks. It'll be really impossible to know who those people were. So we do really worry that this is going to cause little pockets of outbreak, and those pockets of outbreak will be really hard to stop.
Overall, what kinds of new data is out for health professionals, or maybe some of the new information that you're learning about the virus?
Yeah, well, this is a virus where we're learning something new every day. One of the things that we've learned recently about this virus is that it really does appear to attack the vascular system. So the vascular system meaning the blood vessels that we have throughout our body. And for people who have mild disease, this does seem to be in the lungs. But as the disease gets more and more serious, it seems to attack the blood vessels. And that's why we've been seeing things like strokes and kidney failure and amputations and pulmonary embolism, because it really seems to be attacking the vascular system. And that would also go along with this being much more severe for old people. You know, we usually think of the vascular system when you're born as being a newly paved road. And then over time, depending on how hard you are on your blood vessels, they start to have cracks and potholes and whatever else. So people have hypertension and diabetes. They especially have lots of blood vessel damage. And they're the ones who seem to be really badly hit by this disease.
And for those impacts, is that then mainly for older people that are they're being impacted by those types of things?
Right. So vascular disease, it really does go up with age. You almost never see a kid in the first 20 years with bad vascular disease, but it starts showing up in the 20s and 30s, starts getting more in the 50s and 60s, and then really starts to get quite dominant after age 70, which is almost exactly what you see with the death rate from COVID.
With your background and some of the places you've lived, are you able to interface with other public health professionals, perhaps in other parts of the country periodically?
Yes. So I've been asked to be on a number of nationwide panels and have met with a bunch of people. I was on a panel earlier last week with a guy from Boston. And boy, they've had really such a terrible time there. And then friends in New York have had just a miserable time. You know, one person said that they've been to 12 different funerals in the last 3 months for relatives who died from COVID.
Wow. And what about maybe the some of the medical side of things that folks in those areas, what's it like to be doing what they do, perhaps similar to what you do here, doing in those areas when you have that high level of an impact of COVID-19 and the fatalities, et cetera?
Yeah, it for many people back east has been a once in a lifetime kind of event. The people in the emergency room are used to seeing lots of death and destruction, lots of disease. But friends who've been back there said this, you've never seen anything like this. So pick the worst night. And this is the worst night every night for many months at a time. So I think we're going to start to see some PTSD among those people, as well as just some exhaustion. Can't be working that many hours around that much death for that long. So we're worried about our colleagues back east.
Yeah, I would presume that that level of work makes them very susceptible to even more just common issues from getting so worn out.
Yeah, and we've seen a number of suicides among people who work in the healthcare system back east. Just seeing all of that death is not good for your psyche.
And now contrast that again when you talk about that. This area here, you said Oregon was the fourth lowest concentration in the U.S.?
Yeah, the fourth lowest attack rate, so that's death per million. So we have about 4,000 cases and about 4 million people, whereas places like New York have 10 times the rate. The only states that have done better than Oregon have been Alaska and Hawaii, who benefit some from their geographic isolation, and then Montana that also benefits from its very low population and reasonable isolation.
And, of course, places like Hawaii, because generally you have so many people coming and going as tourists, they have still, in effect, 14-day quarantine if you go to Hawaii, and right now, if you had to go to Hawaii and get into a quarantine, that pretty much discourages most people from going. But if you get off the plane in Hawaii, they literally follow you to your motel room, I'm told, and make sure that you stay in your room for 14 days, and that includes not even going out on the beach, let alone anything else. So a lot of people have seen that as something that's helped with the situation there because you don't have all the coming and going. But, of course, a lot of people are looking forward to that situation improving, because I think this summer a lot of people would love to go to someplace like Hawaii if they could and things are safe by then.
Well, we're certainly hoping that things are going to open up in the next few weeks, and I think we'll talk about that later. And as things open up, I think there's going to be more travel and larger group sizes. So we're looking forward towards that.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer with us on Talking Health. We'll take about a 2.5-minute break. Back with more. Brian Mahoney going to be joining us as well from Douglas Public Health Network. It's Talking Health, looking at COVID-19. In for Lisa Platt, Kyle Bailey of News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon 422, the afternoon report with Douglas County's news team coming up at 5. Keep your radio on. Of course, a lot going on nationally and in Oregon, but we're spending this hour talking about the health aspects of COVID-19. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer, Brian Mahoney joining us now from Douglas Public Health Network. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. It's good to be back.
So remind folks what you do at Douglas Public Health Network.
Well, usually I'm the Public Health Modernization Program Coordinator, and we work with health equity and improving the disease control processes in the region and improving immunization rates. But for the last couple of months, I've reverted back to some of my earlier days and bringing into focus some of the disease intervention skills that I brought.
Yeah, talk about maybe your background and help explain folks why that's going to help you now.
Sure. I started with the Centers for Disease Control in about 1987 as a public health advisor, and the role that I played was a disease intervention specialist. Nowadays, people hear that as spoken about as a case investigator or a contact tracer. But I think that the best vernacular is disease intervention specialist, because really what we're trying to do is to break the chain of transmission. And investigation and tracing have sometimes have a negative connotation. So that's not really what I prefer to be known as. But if I say I'm breaking the chain of transmission, if we're intervening in the spread of disease, then people can see that as, oh, I understand that.
And how long have you been at Douglas Public Health Network?
This is my over 2 years now.
Now, let's talk about this aspect of contact tracing. First of all, why is it deemed important?
It's probably one of the oldest public health measures that we have that works. And normally when people think about stopping disease, they think about maybe they've heard about the pump handle. If you could take the pump handle off the well that was pumping water with disease organisms in it, then that broke the chain. But this is a person-to-person disease, and person-to-person diseases, then you have to trace people and stop them from spreading the disease. And you do that by informing them that they've been either exposed or that the tests now have come back as positive. And then there are things that we can do. Since we don't have preventative medicine for this, we don't have good treatment for it, and we don't have a vaccine for it, the only way that we can actually hold the disease in check is by doing the physical distancing and isolation of sick people and quarantining of those who've been exposed for a long enough period of time so that nobody else is spread until the disease has run its course in those people.
So when you talk about that being used for other things, it makes it sound incredibly simple, the idea of just tracing down and having that help you figure out who you need to be dealing with and who may have been impacted.
Yes, and for the most part, when the CDC started this type of program in public health nationally, it was after World War II, and there were a lot of venereal diseases at the time, syphilis chief among them, which was infecting adults, and then through pregnancy could affect infants and cause infant mortality, stillborn, or long-term problems with the child. And so, when they started out, they said, well, what we really want to do is save babies. So how do you do that? Well, you identify the people who have been infected through the test, through the blood tests, et cetera, and then contact them, notify them of their positive tests, and then find out who they've been with for the what's called the critical period, from the time that they could have got it themselves through the time they could have spread it to someone else. So that could be a long period of time. The difference is that with syphilis, it might be up to a year that you have to go back to all the contacts, the sexual contacts of that person. But with this virus, this COVID-19 disease and the coronavirus that causes it, it's a much shortened interval. We're only looking at around 2 weeks or so of close personal contact. And close personal contact is thought to be within 6 feet of someone for 15 minutes or longer. Generally, that means household contacts, people at work. We've seen some outbreaks in correctional institutions where people have been, forced to gather together. And then there are some other large gatherings. So those are really that's really where the bulk of these cases are coming from. It's not thought to spread by passing somebody on the sidewalk, for instance, if you're walking down. And that's why outdoor activities, keeping the physical distance works so well. So we're not asking about everybody in your life. We're just asking about those close contacts. And then again, if those can be identified and we can talk to them, we can talk with them about how this would help them themselves, their family, their friends, and their community in stopping the spread.
So that takes off from the table things like, for instance, cashiers at grocery stores, people are wearing masks. You've got the shields from customers to the clerks in most places now. And then your contact time is 2 or 3 minutes generally. You come in, you buy something, get your stuff, and go. So people like that then are not part of what you're looking at.
Not entirely, exactly. But those things, the mask and the shields and keeping the physical distancing, that all works to reduce the risk. There is no real zero risk unless you just never see anybody. But if you come in contact with folks close enough, often enough, there's still that risk.
Now, obviously, when you're dealing with what seems like new in terms of never having to deal with this for our lifetimes before, something quite like this, a lot of people are a little concerned about contact tracing and sort of being a little bit of I want to say maybe overreach or something. Address some of the fears out there for people who tend to not think of it in a good light.
Sure. So what we have are people who are trained to do the work in a manner that is, I should say that it's interpersonal and it's confidential, and we take personal identification information very seriously. We don't want to get involved in anything except to break the chain of transmission. So things like confidentiality, people talk about HIPAA. Folks who do this work could potentially lose their job if they were not very careful about the confidentiality nature of it. And we do want to make sure that people are calm when we talk to them. People get, we understand that there's a shock if somebody says you've been exposed to a communicable disease. We understand that. So we have to have some sort of emotional quotient, some sort of emotional intelligence, and be able to de-escalate some things and have a little humility and be very non-judgmental about it. So we're very conscious of the impact both on the work as we do it. If we're effective with it, we're very conscious of the effect on this, that it could stop the disease, but we also have we're very conscious of the effect it has on the individual, both from their point of view and also on what they anticipate to be things like, how am I going to quarantine myself, what are these things going to mean to me. So it does heighten the tension.
I imagine too, for some people, when you have those conversations and you've got to take a quick look at your life, whether you live by yourself or you have a partner, or you've got kids, extended family, what's your work environment normally? I mean, there's a lot of things there that people, probably spend some pretty serious time thinking about.
That's exactly right. And some of the support that we want to be able to provide the people are to be able to say, what sort of issues would you have quarantining yourself? And then we hopefully can figure out a plan to make sure that there's food delivered, that the kids are watched, that the grandparents, if they're adult caregivers, that something like that is thought of, so that they're not floundering on their own.
So is the idea then, let's just say you had somebody in their 40s, they've got kids that are teenagers at home, they've got a husband or spouse with them. Are you wanting them to quarantine, basically stay in a bedroom or the family room, or stay somewhere and stay isolated from those folks that they normally are in contact with in the family?
That's right. So if it's possible, we recommend that a person have their own bedroom and own bathroom. And that only things like, meals or other things that are brought to the room and taken out, so the person doesn't have to go in and out and wander around through the house. There are some cases, however, where whole families are quarantined at one time. They've all been exposed at once. So in that situation, it may be that there's not necessarily needed to isolate everybody from each other.
Wow. So for some... So for some folks, that would be real complicated then. I mean, if you live in a one-bedroom apartment and you have one other person living with you, for instance, that gets complicated.
It does. But we try and work through those little issues.
Interesting. What kind of responses, you talked about trying to make kind of an emotional connection with people and understand that you realize that this is some hard news to get. I imagine that the variety of responses you folks and others around the state that are doing this right now have gotten have been pretty all over the board.
I think for the most part, most people are successful. What people need to realize also is that this is voluntary. The participation, following the recommendations, it's all voluntary. So we know that there are some people who are quarantined that, after a while they want to go outside and they just go outside. So they're not quarantine police.
Interesting. Well, and I understand that the approach in some other countries, in some cases, is perhaps a bit more intense.
I don't really know very much about what's going on in other countries. I do know that other countries that have implemented good practices and did contact tracing and had a strong quarantine isolation policy in place have done very well, like Taiwan, for instance.
Interesting. We're going to take a break, talk more when we come back. Brian Mahoney from the Douglas Public Health Network, Dr. Bob Dannenhofer will be back on with us. We're going to be talking about sort of the average day for what's going on right now at DPHN and an overview of all the work that they're doing to deal with the situation that we are all in right now. Talking Health, Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt, back in 3 minutes, 4:35 at News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here. Kyle Bailey for Lisa Platt taking a look at the COVID-19 situation with County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Brian Mahoney from the Douglas Public Health Network. Dr. Bob, first of all, maybe explain your role as the County Public Health Officer and what that entails.
So I'm both the County Public Health Officer and the Public Health Administrator, so responsible for the public health programs here in Douglas County. Now, remember, a few years ago, public health was moved, the activities for public health were moved into a not-for-profit called Douglas Public Health Network, and I also helped them there with some medical strategy stuff. But as the public health officer and public health administrator, I'm responsible for quarantine orders if we ever need them, responsible for the legal parts of public health.
So you're dealing with those aspects as well as still working as a pediatrician.
Yeah, I'm still doing that too. Most times the public health job doesn't take a tremendous amount of time. Certainly during this episode, it's taken a lot of time.
And what's a normal day like for you?
So we usually start early in the morning. I get up early and review the data throughout the world that happened the night before. And see where things are hot around the world and hot around the country. Our group meets every morning to go over all of the cases and the things that we've done before. We've got just a great crowd over here at DPHN that helps to review each of the cases. So, for example, if there is a new case, a new contact of a case, we go through that so we can understand better what's going on. I then have lots of briefings through the week. I do these twice weekly briefings with the clinics, a weekly briefing with the medical officers throughout the community, with Facebook twice a week, KQEN, it seems like every day, and then work with anybody who has questions. So I probably each day get a half a dozen or so questions from businesses and other leaders about how they should approach what goes on. At Douglas Public Health Network, we're also very carefully following the PPE situation. So as you know, there's been a shortage of PPE, especially masks and gowns, and the group at PPE is helping us with that. And then we've also been setting up to get a cadre of contact tracers who can help us to trace these cases, as Brian explained.
So we're now, of course, we've had this low need for them at this point, which is a good thing. But which sectors of folks, where did you pull from to find some of these people that you could pull in as contact tracers as needed?
So some of these contact tracers are retired people, so retired medical people in the community who want to come back to help. Some are people who were working in jobs that got furloughed during this time. Either they worked at schools or in dental clinics and have been furloughed, and they've come to help us. We've recruited in the community, and I think this next week you'll start to see on our webpage some job announcements for some more contact tracers. Really what we want is people who can connect with people in the community. You don't have to have a good background, but you have to be able to connect, and you have to be able to get people to tell you things that that may be a little either embarrassing or a little uncomfortable for them to tell, so that we can track down where you might have gotten the disease.
Brian, talk about maybe an average day for the work that you're doing.
Well, I have a couple of roles, but primarily we're running an incident management team right now, and so I'm the planning section chief. Now, we have an operations chief, and that's primarily where the epidemiology goes on. So I try and look ahead at things that we may need. So, for instance, right now we are looking at perhaps more contact tracers here. So I'm helping by drafting up job descriptions. I've done some training with some folks who are needing how to do contact tracing. And so I get myself involved in a lot of those things. Generally speaking, it's planning and seeing what else needs to be done.
How different is this during this particular time than what DPHN would have going on in a, you know, 4 or 5 months ago?
Well, we all have roles that we play here. We're usually funded for doing different programs, and so those programs were what we were primarily doing before this. However, one of the big programs that we have besides the disease control, communicable disease control, is the Public Health Emergency Preparedness Program. And we're fortunate that that was fairly robust, so that when we got into this situation, we were able to then switch from business as usual to public health emergency response activities. And everybody has been playing their role in that. Everybody in the incident management system has a position, so they know what they're doing and they're familiar with that position.
It almost seems like what's going on over there right now, one of the things that I've thought about this before, given this current situation, it reminds me a little bit of almost being like a MASH unit, for those of us who remember that show.
Yes, I remember the show.
And obviously very intense time. Now, you talked about working for CDC, and I know you've done a number of other things. So I'm sure over time you've built a lot of relationships with folks that are in public health in whatever role around the U.S. and perhaps farther. Have you been reaching out to some of your contacts to see what their work is like?
Well, at the beginning of this, say back in February, one of my colleagues at the World Health Organization, Dr. Bruce Aylward, led the contingent that went to China to see what was going on in China. And when he came back, there was a video that I knew of, and I shared that with Dr. Bob. And it was very remarkable. And then I wrote him an email, and he responded. And it was just nice to be able to keep in touch with him. So, yeah, so that was and that's really where we took off from right then when he said, this is what you should be doing. And we go, oh, my God, we're going to have to start doing something and thinking about this. Also, I've worked with the state of Oregon for a lot of years. And so a lot of the people that I'm working with now sort of remotely through the state public health or through the county health departments, we've all been sort of preparing for this for 20 years. And so it's good to reach out and still have made those contacts. In the middle of an emergency, it's not the time to start making a lot of relationships. Those relationships should be made in the planning phases well beforehand.
So
those things are working out right now.
I imagine, like a lot of other things in life, those professional contacts, maybe professional and maybe also folks that are genuine friends that you might hang out with at normal times, having those people around you in some level, even remotely, when you have got the time with them in the past and you know that you can trust their good sense and things like that is probably very, very helpful to sort of, you know, bounce things off of each other, for example.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, we've been working with other counties so far. Just a couple of days ago, let's see here, it was Union County asked us about our drive-through clinic and said, can you help us? How did you do that? And we've been working with Carrie Bruciotti, the public health administrator there, for years. We've had Lane County. We're working with Marion County right now. We did training with Coos County a couple weeks ago. So these are not just old relationships, but there are some new relationships and different relationships. And so we are trying to, if we can, help and assist our other public health colleagues.
I remember three plus years ago, I suppose now, when the first drive-through clinic for flu vaccinations was done. And I remember, like, it kind of caught a lot of people off guard, but I remember Dr. Dannenhofer saying at the time, this will be helpful to do it for this, but we're really looking to put all this infrastructure and sort of protocols together for some kind of situation in the future where it would be especially helpful.
Exactly. And so proper prior planning prevents poor performance.
Yeah, I haven't heard that one in a while. And Dr. Bob, this really has been interesting because people in other places have looked at Douglas County and went, wow, how come I didn't think of that?
Well, we had great staff, so that's why we thought of it. And our great staff came up with it. And my job here is just to help them along. This is really a great crowd we have here.
And for these clinics, especially for smaller areas, I know you've talked about just the cost efficiency of how you operate these drive-through clinics. It's a lot easier to test a number of people in a short amount of time.
Not only can we test a lot of people in a short period of time, we can also do it while preserving our PPE. So the PPE are the masks and the gowns and whatever. And because we use Tyvek suits and personal respirators, we can use one set of PPE for the entire testing clinic rather than using a new one each time. And so it's been very efficient and very people-sparing in the way we've done it. We've been doing this on the weekends in Reedsport, and Tori Prowitz and I did it this weekend, and we did 10 of them in just less than 20 minutes.
Going to take a break in our final segment when we come back. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and also Brian Mahoney of Douglas Public Health Network. Going to talk about Dr. Bob's role as an advisor to the governor and also the phase two reopening potential for later this week and other things that people ought to be mindful of as we go through this time of COVID-19. Talking Health 449 back in 2 minutes. News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon 452, final segment of the program this week. County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer is one of the advisors joining Governor Kate Brown, a task force of health professionals. I know a lot of things, obviously, Dr. Bob, that are going on with that group are in the confidential realm, but give folks a sense of kind of what that group is doing.
Well, these are seven of the most accomplished physicians in the state. I'm not quite sure where they asked me, but a bunch of really accomplished people who get together several times a week to go over the very specifics of what's going on. So we've asked for a evidence-based process. This is clearly an evidence-based process among this group. And we talk about the projections of what's going on and what we need to do in the future. The governor has been great at listening. She obviously has to make decisions in the end, but she's really gotten good advice, I think, and has really listened.
How diverse are the opinions that come out of this group?
Very. So, these are people from all over the state. These are people, some of whom work with hospital systems, some who work on the front lines of COVID, some who work in public health. And so this is a very diverse group, and we certainly don't always agree.
And how often are you interfacing as a group with the governor?
At least once a week, but then we're frequently called in for special times to talk about other special topics.
Now, we are anticipating the potential of going to phase two reopening in Douglas County on Friday. The county commissioners have put in the application letter. We talked to Commissioner Freeman about that earlier today. We've got a story up about that from the weekend at 541radio.com. What kinds of things could change in phase two, and what do people need to keep in mind as there's a potential of going that route?
So what we're looking to see is that the opening that we did in phase one, which was our first step, wasn't too far. So what we saw in the phase one reopening was a big group of cases, a group of cases that could overwhelm either the healthcare system or our supply of PPE. It then wouldn't make sense to take another step. The good news is we haven't seen that, at least locally. So there's a little bit of delay. So you remember we opened up on May 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th. Those cases would just be showing up this week, because if you got infected, say, on the 17th, you wouldn't show symptoms until the 22nd or 23rd. Take a little bit of time to get tested, a little bit of time to get the test back, and we would just be noticing them now, and we haven't. So that suggests that there was not a lot of spread of the disease, at least in that first weekend of being open.
And we've seen consistently, and I haven't seen the update from this afternoon from the Oregon Health Authority, but it does seem like the numbers statewide are diminishing, though certainly Multnomah and Marion counties are probably the two counties that remain with the highest numbers.
So I think what we're seeing is in non-groups, but the number of cases is indeed going down. There's a big outbreak among seasonal workers in a farm up in the Portland area, and then there's a big outbreak in the Oregon State Penitentiary. But other than that, the number of cases is really going down quite nicely.
And so that makes it more likely, presumably, that a number of counties will get into phase two reopening. I know that they've got throughout the week to submit applications. Not everybody has done the paperwork yet. And as of earlier today, I think 12 of the counties that are in phase one are asking to go to phase two.
Well, we were a bit of an overachiever, so we got our thing in very quickly.
So we got about 3 minutes left here as we kind of look at some things people ought to remember. What are you seeing on the area of masks? Are you seeing much of a change locally?
I'm not seeing much of a change. What I'm seeing is so much confusion about masks. Again, the most important thing is to stay home when you're sick and to socially distance. But at times you can socially distance, then wearing a mask helps to prevent others from you giving them disease if you're one of these super spreaders. And what we've learned with this disease is that many people have the disease, won't even give it to their spouse at home. Some people give it to a few people, but then there's the occasional person that will give it to many, many, many people. And so we hear these stories about the one guy at the cocktail party gave it to 40 people, or the lawyer gave it to 50 people, or the person at the choir practice gave it to 50 people. And those are the kind of things we're trying to prevent. In all of these cases, none of these people were that ill. And so if you could wear a mask and decrease your spread to those people, that's what we're looking for. Now, it is confusing because the World Health Organization came out with something this week that said that masks were not one of their prime strategies. And the reason for that was that there are many people in the world who can't get a mask. In the United States, since these cloth masks are widely available, we have made over 10,000 of them in the county. The recommendation would be to wear them when you can't ensure social distancing. So at the beginning of every day, I put on my neck gaiter and use that as my face covering. It's a perfectly adequate face covering. You know, for many years, I wore a tie, and ties served no purpose, and they were much more uncomfortable. Wearing a gaiter is much less uncomfortable and serves a much better purpose.
I was out some over the weekend, and it seemed like it really varied. I was in the one location. The number of folks wearing masks seemed pretty high, maybe the most highest that I'd seen. And then I was elsewhere, and it actually seemed the opposite, like maybe less people were wearing masks. So it really seems to depend on where folks are going. But certainly when you're out of the grocery store and things like that, you're quickly passing by a lot of folks.
You are. And, you know, what I worry about is that, you know, someday if I ever got the disease and then the contact tracer said, well, where were you the days before? And I said, well, I was at the grocery store and I didn't wear a mask and I went to the gym and I didn't wear a mask. And then I would worry that I might have given it to these people. If I did wear a mask, my risk of giving it to someone else is much decreased, more than 50%, we think. And so that's the reason I wear a mask. Again, it's a personal thing. We do not have mask police out there. And I think it's a sign that I'm aware of what's going on, a sign of respect for others, and I'm happy to do it, but I'm never going to criticize somebody who doesn't.
And obviously, one of the things a lot of people are doing to relieve stress and cope right now is getting out and doing those long walks.
Right. And so going out for a great long walk or great long bike ride is great to do. The YMCA opened up today with distancing. So I'd encourage people to go back to the YMCA or to another gym. I'd encourage people to just enjoy the outside. It's a beautiful, beautiful week.
County Public Health Officer Dr. Bob Dannenhofer and Brian Mahoney from Douglas Public Health Network, thanks for being on this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
And thank you.
That wraps up Talking Health for today and for this week on News Radio 1240 KQEN. The podcast up shortly at 541radio.com.
The preceding program was paid for by CHI Mercy Health Mercy Medical Center. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.